expect that meeting to go on Sunday? Will it be longer?
I would say an hour is fair, because we never seem to do anything in less than an hour. Even when I think it's going to be less, it's always at least an hour. People have too much to say, not the least of which is yours truly. So, okay, anything else?
Will there be choir after?
If there's time.
Oh, choir.
Yeah.
If there's time, yes, there will. And if it feels like it, we may just meet the choir beforehand and talk about what we're going to do, or we may just wait until it's over and see. That's probably the thing that will happen after it's over.
I didn't even think about choir, Joy. I apologize to you. I never thought to ask. I'm not quite totally tuned into that happening there. Okay. We always have too few days in the week. Okay. Any questions or thoughts or anything before we roll on? I'm not really quite sure where we're going, so maybe there are questions or thoughts. Anything else? Oh, good for you. Thank you for rescuing me.
Finances.
We seem to be kind of freeform tonight, because I've been talking so much about communication. Everything that's in these chapters I've been talking about since the first night. So go ahead, Cyrus.
As a male, so traditionally the idea of the male being the breadwinner, it's challenging for me to think of a relationship in which money, the flow of money, or the providing of money is more on one, one than the other. And that's always the case. In a relationship.
Well, unless you happen to just have the same income, it could happen, but anyway.
Exactly. Just your thoughts on how that dynamic can play out.
Well, money, money, sex, these are things people fight over. These are the things that destroy relationships. They don't have to, but they do, because they're just big issues. Money is about... money is enormously about priorities, about value systems, about how you make decisions, about what you think is important, about your sense of security, your freedom, your sense of entrapment. It just implies all sorts of things. If other people's maturity, your sense of their looking out for your welfare, I mean, just it's really not about money. It's about everything that it implies. So when you hit up into money issues in ways that are controversial, you really have to stop and ask yourselves, what are we really discussing? Because you're really not usually discussing $5 or $1,000 or $500,000. You're discussing how do we make decisions and what's important in our lives. We're discussing whether or not I really have a sense of trust in your understanding me and your looking out for me, whether I really need to keep my options open, whether I really think that you're a mature person or not. And you can, I mean, usually, not always, but sometimes when people want to keep their finances separate, sometimes it's not healthy. It's a real sign of people not engaging with each other. On the other hand, I've known couples, I remember one particular time where I just said to them, I really think the best solution is for you to really keep your money separate. Because just the way they each dealt with money was so different that neither of them could stand the other way's handling it. But in other ways, their relationship was really quite good. And since they both made a solid income and they neither needed the other to support the other, if they just left it to be one of those areas where it's your idiosyncrasy, you play with it, and it's my idiosyncrasy, and I'll play with it. But oftentimes, an unwillingness to combine finances is indicative of many other levels of fear. But it doesn't necessarily mean you should push against it either. It just may mean that we have so much going for us, let's not mess with this one. This one just doesn't work. But as I'm saying, almost always you're not talking about money. You're talking about something completely else. I mean, that one of the hardest things in close, shared life relationships is quite simply what's important to us. And that's what often happens when people who are devoted to the spiritual path get involved with someone who may not be. Because it just becomes, when you really get down to how are we really going to decide what we're going to do with our time, with our money? Where will we take our vacations? What will we do with our savings? Just things like that. And if one person's whole sense of the priorities of life are this, and someone else's are the priorities of life are this, you really can run into real big issues. I often say to people, and it's worth remembering, that it's really not hard to love someone. You know, if you have a relatively expansive heart, you can love lots of people. And I don't mean passionate romantic love, but you can profoundly and deeply love a lot of people. But to make a life with someone is a different thing. And that's one of the problems that people get into, is that they love someone and they don't notice that we could never make a life together. Because just in every way that really matters on a day-to-day basis, it may be that our sense of priorities is completely different, or our relationship to money is completely different, or just many things that are just going to wreck the day-to-day experience. And as Swami says, I don't think he says it in this book, but maybe he does, you know, you should pick a marriage partner with at least some of the criteria you would use if you're selecting a business partner. And that doesn't mean that there's somebody who's going to make a fortune for you, but somebody who fundamentally you know you can work with on life and death issues. Otherwise, it becomes too painful, and you can end up just not being able to maintain your love, because on practical levels, you just don't want the same things. So money becomes one of those. So the best thing to do is, whenever we're fighting about money or disagreeing about money, ask ourselves, what are we really disagreeing about? The same with sexuality. What are we really disagreeing about? What is the undercurrent issue here? What am I really saying when I say whatever I'm saying that has to do with money? And some people do just have to say certain things, like, you know, I have to keep my own bank account because I know if I try in the name of whatever to give this up, it's a step bigger than I can take. And so we say, you know, I love you, I really want to make a life with you, but if I go beyond this edge, the stress of it will destroy what good I have going on here. And so I'm going to need to keep my money separate. I've witnessed this much more at Ananda, especially at Ananda Village, where the lifestyle is more almost virtually everyone works within the context of Ananda Village. And for many years, especially, we just were so impoverished. Well, they're still pretty impoverished up there because of the lawsuits, the oppression of all these lawsuits on us. But we're pretty impoverished here, actually, when you think about it. I forgot. I've grown so accustomed to it, I didn't remember. But I would watch the way people would play out their relationship to their own money in the context of Ananda over years, because of all the years I've been there. And it would always be, you know, when they'd first arrive to live in the community, which, especially at that time, the years I was there, it was a really big sacrifice and a big step. You had to give up a lot to be able to do it. One of the wonderful things about our urban communities is you don't. You're living in an apartment on Alma, then you live in an apartment in our community, and you've just changed your address. You haven't had to just flip out your lifestyle as much as you used to and still do to move to Ananda Village. But people's money to them was the symbol of the fact that they didn't really trust the community. And they really needed to keep their own money, because as long as they had their own money, and people do keep their own money, you should understand it's not a communal environment, but people needed to have money. Really, they needed to have money, because they didn't really know where they were, and they didn't really know who they were with, and they didn't really know what was going to happen. And as long as they had money, they had freedom. And you would watch over years, and I'm talking 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, that the need for freedom began to dissolve. And so therefore the need to feel that you had to have all this money in reserve, also you just began to give way, because you had this sense of, trust is the word I've used once, but just trust, that you just knew where you were, you trusted God, you trusted your environment, and you didn't need to be able to run away at any moment. And so it became less and less and less and less important to have all this money of my own. And it's always very personal. I actually had a woman come to me, and bless her soul, she had the decency to be embarrassed. She was having a terrible traumatic experience. Because whereas their family income used to be $150,000, it had gone down to $110,000. And she was, and this was even like 8 or 10 years ago, and that was a lot more money. And she was honest enough to be embarrassed by how stressed she was about it. You know, and of course, if you have a lifestyle that costs $150,000 a year and you only have 110, you do have a problem. I know one of the vastly overpaid athletes that we worship in this society who was getting his $7 or $10 million and was fighting for it. You know, whenever one of the sports teams was going on strike because they weren't getting $12 million, and one of these men, not helping his cause very much, says, "Well, you know, we need this much money. We have a lot of expenses." I mean, everybody has a level of where they feel nervous, and it depends, again, depends on your karma, it depends on what you've been through, it depends on what's happened to you in your life, it depends how many times you've lived in a stone monastery without a penny and never cared. And you just, people get real funny relationships. I joke about this. Many of you have heard me say this. By the grace of God, I've always had a very, very easy relationship with money. I've also always been taken care of. And I almost mean literally taken care of. Just, I'm taken care of. I don't just mean by God. It's just sort of like, you know, just simple people around me, like husband and father and people like that take care of me. And I'm perfectly happy to be taken care of. And during the years in the middle, I had, when I would say to people, when we lived in Ananda, we had no money. The phrase "no money" means different things to people. To money people, it means no liquid assets, you know, or no money beyond the stuff in the stock market and the house and, you know, the car and so on. But when I meant no money, I meant no money. Like, I didn't have a bank account for, you know, almost 10 years because I didn't have enough money to have a bank account. There was no point. It was just easier to cash the check and put the cash in the jar. But I had a mystic relationship with that jar. It was this little pottery jar. It was opaque. It was very important that it be opaque because you wouldn't want to be able to look in there and actually see how much was in there. You had to just put it in and put the top on it and trust that there would be enough. This was my system. This was my great financial system. But that jar was a really important part of the whole thing because, you know, you develop these relationships. You have your own little superstitions that keep you going. And there was always money in that jar. It was God's way of keeping me going. And I never knew quite how much exactly, but there was always money in that jar. Then I married David, of course, who's more sophisticated financially than I. And I sort of moved into his house carrying the jar. It wasn't even a particularly attractive jar because, you know, in my position, you never actually bought anything. You just had what you had. You know, it was sort of like I brought almost nothing to the marriage anyway. And I, you know, sort of like, what's that? Well, that's where we keep the money. And I mean, I still remember him sort of like looking at it. And of course, with his highly developed aesthetic sense, he noticed that it wasn't even attractive. And he sort of like he put his hands on it, and it was like, like this, because I could tell he didn't respect the jar, you know. And then I just sort of looked at him and looked at the jar like this, and he just so sweetly said, "I don't think we'll need this anymore," you know. And but it was a moment of just saying, "All right," you know. I had my whole way of making myself safe, and now you're saying to me, accept something else that is unknown. And it was, I mean, as I said, money for me is not a big issue. So I don't want to make more out of it. But I still remember very clearly him wanting to get rid of that jar, and my sort of telling him, but if we get rid of that jar, you know, how will we know how much money we have? How will we have enough money? He said that we would have a bank account. I had to tell him that I didn't know how to balance a checkbook because I never had done it.
Can you go to Stanford?
I do. But I flunked out. But I never have. To this day, I've never balanced a checkbook. I just, and I sort of think, well, what happens if something happens to David? My answer was, I'll bake cookies for somebody who'll balance my checkbook. Although I'm more than capable of it, I'm sure. But the end of that whole story is, that's a little microcosm, a trivial microcosm, but these are real things. And you just, I'll tell one more story, which is very closely related to that. Sharon, is your question important, or can I wait till next week? David and I went through a cycle, and I used this. This was a long ago story, but it was such a perfect example. It helped me a lot. I've been married twice. My first marriage, I married a very fine man with whom I had a tremendous rapport. Very, very good fellow, but we did not, as I often say, we didn't know what to do with our relationship. I was 19, he was 21. We just had no idea what you do. So we just kind of made it up and made it up very poorly, and it didn't work out very well. It wasn't meant to be, but nonetheless, didn't mean we did it well. Now, let me think, where was I going with this? Oh, yes, but part of what happened in that was because I was actually looking for a guru and I didn't know it. You know, I just sort of discipled myself to my husband, who was a fine husband, but he was not a master, so it was, you know, just a teeny-weeny bit off balance. And he, being a person of strong opinions and quite willing to share them, you know, was quite happy to have someone who essentially wanted to do whatever he said. Why not, you know? We were too immature to recognize this is not a basis for a marriage. But so when he would, either directly or indirectly, I would get the impression that something would be positive in our life together, I would do my best to do it. And I just essentially tried to mold myself to the image that he had of what I ought to be. And he was not a fool. He was very insightful. So it wasn't so terrible. But nonetheless, out of my desire to cooperate with his image, I tried to do things that were not a natural next step for me. I tried to stretch farther than either I should have at all, or certainly farther than I should have at that time. I made promises I shouldn't have made. He asked things of me he shouldn't have asked. You know, if we'd been more attuned to each other in a more realistic way. And none of this was done badly. He wasn't a bully, and I wasn't an idiot. It was just ignorance more than anything like that. I was a little bit of an idiot, but that's something else. When I married David, you know, which was 10 years almost after that marriage broke up, a long time later, I'd spent a lot of time in between trying to figure out how something that had started out so wonderful and had been so painful to lose had been lost. And I became aware of a sort of the syndrome I just described to you, that I made promises I shouldn't keep, I shouldn't have made, because I didn't have the power really to keep them. And then when I didn't keep them, it became a symbol of not loving him. Do you see what I mean? And so David and I went through a little cycle. I've mentioned to you before, which I always say with reverence, David is a wonderful housekeeper. He's so good. You know, he's just very energetic, and he really likes a clean house, and so he puts out wonderful energy. And I hate to clean houses, really profoundly. I will never vacuum unless I'm in seclusion for like 3 weeks and I have nothing to do, then I may vacuum. And I particularly do not like to clean bathrooms. And before we got married, I told David, I don't do housework. I cook, I'll do laundry, I'll mend your clothes, I'll even iron them joyfully, but I don't do housework. And it was fine, because he did housework. So we had this wonderful little house, and he kept it wonderfully clean, and I cooked, and I took care of the clothes. It was a very nice arrangement. And at the time, I wore glasses. So when I would go into the shower or the bathroom, I never had my glasses on or my contacts. So the other thing was that I always thought the bathroom was really clean because I couldn't see it. And so after a year or two of him just really taking care of the house just wonderfully well, at just the right moment, in just the right tone of voice, in just the right way, he asked me if I would help clean the bathroom. It was a completely righteous request. There wasn't anything about it. It was unrighteous. And I really wanted to say that I would clean the bathtub, but I profoundly know that I hate to clean bathtubs. Just as simple as that. And I, no matter how much I loved him, I knew there was a really good chance that I would promise to clean the bathroom, and I would never clean the bathroom. And it crystallized for me this whole reality of, you can't ask something of someone that they can't deliver.